Well, hello everyone, and welcome once again. I am joined by my guest from last time, Wilhelm or William from the channel Consequent Fry. But this time he's brought his mate with him, Peter, who also is known as Lambda. Not that Lambda, a different Lambda. And he is joining us as well. So say hello, Peter.
Yeah, hello. It's an honor to be here.
And you say hello again, William. Sorry.
Hello, hello.
Now, just before we get going, I forgot to mention last time, but you guys are doing an event in Germany, is that right?
Yeah, so I'm one of the co-organizers of the basically German version of the VTAN, the so-called Karlstage, not the Karls stage. Funny little, I didn't think about this when I came up with the name, but it's basically a event where lovely other centrist and sensible people from all over the world come to listen and discuss very interesting topics that we also usually discuss in our videos, but this time in person. The topic of this year is basically reshaping Europe. And if you listen to the last episode, then, well, it's basically right up this alley asking the question, so where should we go, how it's going to look like, and what can we even do? There are going to be lovely speakers for the German guys. Schattenmacher will be there. Then we have a couple of English speakers, Ed Dutton, and a couple of Americans are going to come over as well. So if you're up for good discussions, a very, very nice location in central Germany. Again, last year we hosted it in a castle, so we had a complete castle for all of the attendees. And this time we're gonna one up it again, and yeah, it's gonna be a great time.
What are the Americans there for? You're gonna put them in medieval stocks and throw tomatoes at them, or are they?
No, we're gonna show them culture. So a little anecdote, if I may, from last year, because it's in Germany, we had to do some German student culture. Basically organized drinking, because, well, we're Germans, and we love order and organization. We sang sea shanties in you have to imagine a whole hall of a castle with even, the armor sets on the sides and a huge long table. The beer was flowing. The music was good. We had a pianist playing the game, the piano. First, we sang some sea shanties, and then a couple of, maybe a bit naughty German student songs from the 1800s. And we were standing on top of the tables singing, at least the young guys that wanted to do this. And the Americans, one of the Americans came up and had FaceTime on with his mates in America and said, like, look at what the Germans are doing. You guys have to come here next year. I guess it was not just an academic discussion. It was also a lot of fun, a good time with people in Europe. I guess if you're also acquainted with, I think, Walrus. Yeah. He put it lovely and said, well, there was fun. People had a good time. And then I said, well, I started the mandatory fun. So because it's Germany, you also have to have mandatory fun. All right, enough of that. Great topic, great people. See you there.
What is it about Germans and dancing on tables anyway? But anyway, I'll just remind people, Foundations of Shakespeare is now out. You can get it on pre-order. It's not actually out yet. You can get it on pre-order. If you send a receipt of Foundations of Shakespeare, the course, to the publisher, you can get it for 50% off. Speaking of which, I still have my January sale on. That means only one thing. It's promo code SHORJAN. I'm going to play this message. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how smartphones are literally making people more stupid.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure. SHORJAN.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, 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 and
sure, Jan. Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure,
sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jim.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's had mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, 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 and so, sure.
All right, so you chaps wanted to talk about smartphones. You know, at the moment, my smartphone is broken. It's doing this thing where it's resetting every 2 minutes or so. I can't do anything on it. If I try to ring someone, by the time it's rebooted and so on, it then shuts itself off again. And I'm thinking of not replacing it. My heart says I want to get rid of this damn thing and replace it with an old-fashioned Nokia brick. So, Peter, I think you were the one who suggested this topic. Why do you want to talk about how smartphones are making everybody more stupid?
Because I really think smartphones are one of the biggest problems of our time. We have many problems. First of all, of course, migration, and then maybe geopolitical stuff and environmental stuff. But I really think smartphones are the second biggest problem of our time, because in history, there have always been some disrupting technologies and societal change. But I think this time it's different because it's affecting people on a biological level. It's not just changing the circumstances around people, but it's changing the people themselves, especially children, when they already have access to smartphones in the phase where their brain develops. It will not develop normally. So I think this is really one of the biggest problems we have. And just think about it. We, all of us, when we were children, smartphones did not exist. The iPhone came out when I was, I don't know how old, I was maybe 8 years old or so, but it was still a niche technology back then. And the mass adoption only started when I had my brain development already completed, let's say. But nowadays, children are growing up with this device. Even babies or toddlers already are using it. And this really is like child abuse to me. I think it's equally, if not more destructive, to give children a smartphone than to give them access to alcohol or other drugs. It really will change their mind. And 30 years from now, all those smartphone babies, they will have become grown-up adults, but their brains will not work normally. They will not have learned human skills, ways of human interaction and human thinking that have been normal for tens of thousands of years. So maybe a bit of a provocative thesis, but the first Western country that will have a smartphone ban will become the next superpower, because it will be, in two generations from now, the only country who has a population that is not retarded on a mass scale.
Can you go into some specifics? You say, you know, giving a child a smartphone will alter their brain. How exactly? Like, what sort of behaviors, what sort of behavior adjustments does having a smartphone do?
So if you already give them a smartphone when they are really young, when they are toddlers, even let's say not societal skills that you learn, but biological skills like 3D orientation in space, things like that, will not develop normally. Because, and this is a problem with screens in general, but the TV screens, and this is also something I will get onto later, this omnipresence of the smartphone, because a TV already is bad, but the TV is in one place at your home. You can only watch TV in this one room, and if you are not there, you don't have it. So you have this connection of room and watching TV. You cannot do it anywhere else, but the smartphone is everywhere, so they can do it everywhere. And this 2D screen, it really, and I think there have been studies on this, it really changes the way the brain develops in three-dimensional orientation and thinking. So children who grow up with smartphones, they are really worse at 3D orientation, or for example, language skills as well. It's very important to speak with children, even when they are babies, even when they seem to not understand what you say, to speak with them. And when they start to speak themselves, to reply to them and have a conversation in both directions, that you tell them something and they reply and then you reply. But having them in front of a screen instead of real people who talk to them has this kind of one directionality of language. They hear what the others are saying in the screen, in the game or in the video that they are watching, but there's no interaction. So their language skills are damaged. They don't develop as usual. They need much more time to even reach basic children language skills, and they will never reach the top language skills. And this also affects thinking. And one of the worst things is this attention span destruction that we probably all have noticed even in ourselves, but our attention span only got destroyed when we are adults. We would just need a few weeks of not having a smartphone and we would go back to normal, basically. But children who never experienced a normal, natural life without smartphone, they are really not interested in things. And I see this with children that I know myself, the ones that have no access to smartphone at all, they are interested in everything. When you walk with them somewhere, every little ant or bug on the street, they will touch it and play with it and be interested in it in every little detail. And this might be annoying because it takes lots of time to walk a small distance with them. But on the other hand, it's really beautiful. You can explain to them the world. And the smartphone children, they don't care about anything. The natural world is not as flashy and colorful as the smartphone screen, so it's not as interesting to them. And it does not have this constant stimulation of the brain or of dopamine receptors. So they will not have attention spans. And not having a normal attention span limits many other skills, for example, learning, really professionally learning a great skill, a mastery of a skill. This is only possible if you spend lots of time concentrating on something for a long amount of time. And if your attention span is so small that you need to watch a screen every few minutes, you will never be able to really focus on something. And if this already happens in childhood, they will never know how normal people behave or how normal brain development works. And we don't know what happens with people that grew up as babies with smartphones, because the oldest people who grew up with smartphones as babies are maybe 10 years old now. But I suspect if they turn 20 or 30, they really will be retarded and not human, not really human in a way. And they will not be able to do many tasks, and they will be very bad at work because they cannot concentrate on anything. And this is even a geopolitical threat, because they just cannot do anything. You cannot do anything with a population that cannot focus.
Is this not downstream of the internet in general, though? I mean, this is, I guess, a wider question, but I mean, a lot of people, I mean, frankly, my experience of Zoomers has been, to some extent, that they're different. They're functionally different from people from the before times. Because, I mean, the previous before and after was, can you remember life before the internet? I can remember life before the internet. I remember when we got AOL in the 90s or whatever. And I mean, I still draw the difference between real life and online, right? Okay. And I remember the first time I met somebody from the internet, it was a very weird thing for me. It's kind of become a bit more normalized now. But it strikes me that there is something functionally different about that generation, Zoomers, who've only grown up with internet. And this, and the smartphone is just like a further integration of that. One of the issues I've had with wanting to replace this smartphone I've got with a Nokia is that there are all sorts of things that actually require you to have a smartphone now, right? Really little annoying things. Like, for example, my gym, I can book a class on the app. That app does not exist on a desktop. So it's literally either go to the front desk and book it there, or do it on your smartphone. So there's all sorts of little functions, you know, getting into my bank and all sorts of other things that now seem to push you onto it. I also have an old neighbor who's 99 years old, who's not online at all, doesn't have a computer. And the amount of things that are made really, really difficult because you don't have a computer in the modern world is extraordinary. So, I mean, you say the first nation to ban it will become a superpower, but it strikes me that they're almost making it impossible not to have a smartphone at the moment, like for all sorts of things, for work, for, I mean, I'll give you another example, right? With my daughter's school, her homework now goes on this app. It's online, okay? Well, in order to get the homework, I have to go on this app. Again, it's an app. It doesn't exist on normal internet, on desktop. You need a smartphone to access it, and then I have to print it out, and then we upload it again. It's kind of convoluted, but again, this is like the outside world forcing you to have a phone. So what do you do about this, Peter, William?
Yeah, it would to be banned, or at least there would have to be some laws in place that say you have to be able to do everything without smartphones. And coming back to your point about, is the internet the problem with Zoomers or the smartphone? I don't remember the time before internet, but I remember the time before the modern user interface optimized internet. When I was a child, we only had internet on desktop and there was no social media. There was no addicting graphical interfaces. So the internet was something completely different. Back then, it felt kind of like a lexicon or something like this. But the new internet is dependent on the smartphone. Social media apps, they really have to be integrated with the smartphone somehow. And this is what I already teased at before with this omnipresence in space. Because when I was a child, my only internet access was a home desktop PC. I had to go in that specific room, turn on the PC, which took a few minutes back then, and start the internet, which was quite slow. So it was bound to a certain space. And in this way, it's not much different to any other technology. The bad thing about the smartphone really is that you can take it everywhere and you are connected constantly. And another thing about the smartphone that really makes it so dangerous and addicting is this combination of use cases. I remember the first iPhone presentation with Steve Jobs when he said, oh, we will introduce a new telephone and a new internet device and a new MP3 audio player. And the joke then was that all the things are in the same device. You have one device for everything. And it even has more different functionalities. Now you also have a clock on it. It replaces your watch. You can access email. You have a calendar. You have a place to write notes. You even have maps when you need to orientate. You can pay with it. You have an alarm clock and so on, a camera, a flashlight. You can watch movies and so on. You have this connection of completely different tasks in one device. And I bet everybody in the audience has had this moment where he thought just, oh, I have to look at what time it is, took out the phone, and then saw a notification and did, you know, the tour through all the apps, check your Twitter DMs and look on Instagram and so on. And at the end of this, you still haven't looked actually what time it is and you forgot what was the reason why you took out the smartphone. And this is the real dangerous thing that it seems at first glance, and you know, some libertarians, they say this about economic growth. Economic growth, the smartphone is economic growth, but not more resources wasted because you combine all these tasks in one thing. But combining the tasks in one thing makes them connected, and this makes that you have access to all of them at the same time. And this leads to this tour of apps where, oh, let's check what's new on Twitter, let's check what's new on Telegram. And when you stopped with one, you can already go in the next one as well. And you can have it everywhere. And this interconnectivity really is the bad thing, that the device is controlling you and not you are controlling the device. For example, I also hate this with Google Maps, that many people nowadays, they just go somewhere and look in Google Maps. And they because for me, the beautiful part of being in a place I don't know is exploring it and seeing, you know, how it works and how everything is connected. When I go to a different city, I look at the map before to get a rough map in my head where everything is, but then I just go there and follow my instincts. I just look around, and this kind of Google Maps orientation, you are tunneling through the world by an optimized path, optimized not by you, but by some algorithm you don't know. And this takes away a part of life, the exploring of places. This, it is presented as efficiency and as optimization, but really it is control over you, and it takes away your own sovereignty and your own agency.
I think an important thing to make clear is I don't really believe in basically that it was only nefarious for nefarious purposes. Of course, people like Blair see the smartphone and already see all the 1,000 different opportunities to get more power through it. But especially when you look at older boomers or even Gen Xers, for a very, very long time, there was this kind of belief that more technology equals better. So there was a huge push to get so-called smart boards into schools. And the only thing that they did better was that they had like an integrated beamer. Wow. But they were hugely expensive. It was every time a new one got installed, it was like, yeah, we're the school of the future and whatever. And I think this one is shifting now. The state of Saxony, for example, in Germany banned smartphones for under a certain age. So there is slowly resistance starting, because it's really noticeable the difference between even older Zoomers like us or the younger Zoomers that basically grew up with an iPad. And even if you are a, let's say, bad elite who just want to extract as much resources out of your population as you want, but don't really care about their well-being, well, even if you are somebody like that, smartphones are a bad thing, because you know you only get basically walking plants. People that young kids that had an iPad from very young age, they are functionally not really that different from a plant. They just vegetate somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, to me, one of the great mysteries or one of the great strange things about the internet is that, you know, in theory, it's all of human knowledge. The accumulated wisdom of all of human civilization ever put into one place. And yet the net result is that it has not been to make, you know, enlightened individuals or anything like that. It's actually been to destroy knowledge in a strange way. Because it's like, I mean, one of my issues with some Zoomers, not all Zoomers, is that it's not just being functionally retarded. It's, you also just don't know anything because you've always been able to look it up. Right. But if you can always look something up, it means nothing ever stays in. Right. And this in itself, I think, is problematic, as leftists say. And I actually see it getting worse with the advent of AI now, with the advent of the likes of Grok. And, you know, I've noticed the Google now, when you Google something, there's an AI prompt that comes up first and foremost. I actually think it's making the issue even worse, because it's like, well, you know, and I even see, I mean, the thing is, I even see it, you know, like I'm of the generation where we don't have a lot of the, you can say what you want about boomers, right? But they're kind of handy in a way, but they're kind of like know how to do things. Whereas, a lot of people in my generation, myself included, have to like look it up, watch a YouTube video. And I sometimes joke that the guys who make how to do stuff YouTube videos are basically like keeping functional civilization alive, right? Because it's like anything, like, oh, my boiler goes off, or, you know, I have to unblock the loo or something. You know, I mentioned that neighbor the other day, you know, the old one, her loo got blocked. So I went around, I was like, I don't fucking know what to do. But then we got this kind of boomer downstairs neighbor. He came up and he like got the, you can imagine, he got the pipe from a vacuum cleaner, stuck the pipe down the loo, and then blew into it. I was like, fuck it, I wouldn't even think of doing this. All right, but this is what I mean. Like, he's kind of handy in that way.
Yeah.
But a lot of, like, my dad is like that. He's just kind of handy. And it, like, this is what boomers are like. for all their ills, they're kind of good at that sort of stuff. But it's because they come from a world where you just couldn't look stuff up. You have to accumulate the experience and the knowledge and so on. So I even see it in myself, you know, and I'm a fair bit old. I'm in my 40s, but in a way, the retardation started with us. And I grew up playing Nintendo and things like this. So, yeah, I worry about this. I think you guys are onto something here.
Yeah, and there is this, let's say, anti-intellectual sentiment of mostly the lower classes, where they, because I have lots of, let's say, universal knowledge. I know lots of things about different topics. And then they say, but I don't need to know this because I can Google it if I need to know it. But this really is the wrong approach to knowledge, because the point of knowledge is not to replace Google or to replace books or something, but it is to know what exists. In a way, your knowledge is not the book itself, but the table of contents. And you need it to, you need to know things to know what to look for even. And only if you have common knowledge in different areas, you can make mental connections. They don't really understand this connectivity of knowledge, because of course, if I need to know a certain detail, I can Google it or I can look it up in a book, but I can only really, as a human being in the higher sense, work in the world if I already know what kind of things exist. And if I need the details, yeah, I can look them up. But really, as you said, this kind of Googling mentality, you have all the knowledge of the world saved in one place, but people don't even know how to access it because they don't know what to Google for. They don't even have a mental map of knowledge. And this really is the bad thing about it.
Now, with all of the institutions, there's a very big drive to push everything online, okay? And it happens at a national level as well. Like, there's been a big push in this country, you know, the NHS that everybody talks about. There's the NHS app, right? There's a bid to push everything online. And then with AI, to even, like, replace some of the functions of, let's say, a doctor with an AI prompt or something like this. Do you see, as this problem gets worse, a sizable pushback where you do get some countries who decide, actually, we're going to pull stuff offline rather than pushing everything online? Because that's been almost an unstoppable momentum over the past 20 years. How would that process even go? Because once it's there, it's hard to put it back. Go on, yeah.
Excuse the Lord of the Rings reference, but I think it's akin of throwing the ring into the fire, because all of this digital centralization is an enormous nexus of power and control. And for a bureaucratic managerial state to throw all of this out of the window and pass on the absolute centralization opportunity it has, it's basically like asking, I don't really see it happening unless there's a major outside threat or basically pressure from all of the non-functioning people that you create from that. That otherwise, I don't really see it happening.
I guess the other question to ask of you, Peter, or your basic thesis that the first nation to do this becomes a superpower is, does it actually confer some competitive advantage to do this? Does it cut costs? Does it, i.e., if you don't do it, do you lose an edge? And that would be a genuine question.
Yeah, and this is the difficult part of it, because on the first look, on the short time horizon, it is more efficient to have a digital infrastructure and have everything digitally. Of course, it's cheaper if people just can do it on the phone and don't have to go to a place where somebody is working who needs to get paid to do it on paper. So, and this is why this technology could advance so quickly, because it seems to be more efficient, but there are all those downsides. So really, and this is a question I have asked myself many times, what is the role of the state in the 21st century? You know, I'm not a libertarian who says it should only provide essential services like law or security, but I'm also not this kind of authoritarian who says the state should control everything. But I really think, and I think in history, 100 years in the future now, historians, they will lose their mind. How could the elites in the 2020s be so stupid and so irresponsible to let this extremely destructive technology loose on the population without any control? I think this will be a great scandal of history. But nowadays, the elites, they really don't have the mentality to do it. But I think it has to be controlled. The role of the state in the 21st century has to be at least to protect people from predatory technology, including smartphones, but maybe also mobility. I think there's too much mobility. And later in the century, biotechnology. But the elites currently, they have this weird, I don't even want to call it liberal, but liberal in a broader sense, mentality, where on the one hand, they really want to minimize harm and danger. For example, if you are a child, I remember this from my childhood, all the cool things at the playgrounds, they got removed because some idiot hurt himself once. So the cool trees where the children could climb on, the lower branches were cut off, so there was no access for the children to climb and so on. And children are not allowed to play with weapons or do chemistry experiments and so on. So those kind of physical dangers, which really are not that bad, because what's going to happen, you maybe might break your leg, but it will heal again. Those kind of dangers, they are removed everywhere for children and for adults as well. But on the other hand, children are just allowed to have access to a smartphone, which is, if you think about it, way more dangerous. I would much rather have my children play with real swords than or knives or whatever than with a smartphone, because the type of damage it does to them is, in my consideration, way worse. I would rather have them have a cut on their finger than have their brain permanently destroyed. So this kind of, I don't know if it's liberal, but these people can just use this technology. The state is in no position to ban this. But why not? Because it is inflicting damage on people. It is inflicting damage on society as a whole. And once the Zoomers and Gen Alpha grow up, it will really make problems. Because I have also heard stories that Zoomers really are not good at work. They lack the attention span. They look on their phone. It's not just this, we don't want to work because we don't want to pay taxes for foreigners, but also this really a different working mentality because of the shortened attention span. And this is a problem. But I don't believe the current elites, they have the power to do it, because banning smartphones, even just for children and teenagers, and I think banning it for children would be very easy. It would be an easy sell. It would be no trouble legally with the current constitutions and so on. But even banning it for teenagers would be considered authoritarian, and this is damaging liberty. But on the other hand, all this bureaucracy and safety measures, for some reason, they are not considered authoritarian. It's a really schizophrenic state. So we need to replace the current elites, not just to deal with the foreigners, but also to deal with the smartphone problem. Because in the long run, it really will bring an advantage to us, because, well, our population would not be retarded. And of course, even third world countries, or I think third worlders, brown people, as some people call them, they are affected even worse by the smartphones, because they have even less mental resistance to it. And once the internet was opened up to the third world, to this general easy access to the internet with smartphones, it really got worse. Even social media was better when it was pretty much white only, but now it's flooded with third worlders. It's even worse.
One of the things we didn't get onto is the political consequence of hyper online smartphones and so on. And another reason I want X banned is that it has created a kind of new hyper reality as well, where, I mean, there was this saying that X is not the, like, Twitter's not the real world, right? And then there was a pushback that actually Twitter is the real world. I think there was a very brief window in which Twitter was perhaps the real world, but now it's become a kind of hyper reality in which all sorts of things come and go. Massive events happen online, forgotten about a week later, 2 weeks later, that never actually touch normal people. Never, like, if you weren't on Twitter, you wouldn't even know it had happened, right? But in the head canon of the people who take part in it, some sort of narrative has gone on, or shifting the Overton window or something, right? I have come to the view that a lot of what goes on there is simply a containment mechanism to prevent actual organization of any sort. Because as long as you're surfing those kind of slop waves, you're not doing anything. In fact, all you're doing is basically making money for Elon Musk.
Yeah. I mean, the best example was this one Scottish girl with the two knives or one axe or whatever. For a week long, it was basically the new symbol of the resistance or whatever. And a week later, it was poof, gone. Something new happened. And I think, I don't know who was it, but recently there's this new girl type of resistance coming up in Britain on British Twitter. And it's going to be the same, like 3 weeks in, try to ask the people who was this this character, and maybe even less than half will be able to answer it.
And of course, my favorite example, Ala Abda El Fattah. Who's that, you might ask? Well, exactly. But I was roundly denounced for not being outraged about that. So now every single day for the next year, I'm reminding people on Twitter, if I stay on Twitter for a year, that is, if my smartphone finally gives up the ghost, I might not replace it. But there's this Egyptian activist that people were upset about for literally one day before the slop cycle had moved on. And now it's like, now it's so much ancient history. It only happened 2 weeks ago. Do you remember like the days where a story would happen and people might talk about it for a couple of weeks at least or a month? But now the hyper-reality moves on so fast that the thing that you were snarling, snorting smoke out the nose about just 1 week ago, the most important thing on earth, now is ancient history and you don't care about it. This is not real politics. It's not only slop, it's a hyper-real nonsense world. And we have to unplug from it. We have to get out of it.
Yeah. You can only win this game by not playing it. But one question I have in the last couple of months is the question of the, not really forced, but basically accepted radicalization of many parts of the Zoomers in left-wing direction and right-wing direction by some parts of the permanent security state. For example, it's not just the right-wing propaganda that suddenly made a huge surge. I remember only a year ago or so, there were basically no Fuentes videos on Instagram or X or somewhere. They existed, but they were in the digital ghetto. They were blocked by the algorithm, if not completely deleted automatically. And suddenly, like overnight, he appeared on Tucker. He suddenly made an appearance everywhere, and this is everybody's mouth. But it's not just the right-wing version, which is the Fuentes. There are also left-wing versions of it. And of course, you could say, yeah, the left-wing is part of the state. Okay, but why the sudden appearance of Fuentes? And who's behind it? Because for years and years, he existed in his political ghetto in that sense, or in his little sphere of the online world. Some people knew about him, but not the mainstream. And suddenly he was made mainstream. And I really don't buy the idea that it was completely organic. He has some friends, or at least maybe somebody decided to use him as a weapon.
My feeling on that is that certain people want to have a conversation about anti-Semitism at the moment. I've got my radio stuck on LBC, and the word anti-Semitism was used about 10 times in the space of 20 minutes when I was driving here this morning. So clearly there's a bid to get that talked about. There's just been a big hate speech bill in Australia, pretty punitive laws brought in. And I think that ultimately the role of trying to mainstream him was to try to make this idea more prescient. Now, you could argue that some aspect of that backfired, but I honestly think that that is the reason why it was kind of put front and center for a while. Because the, I mean, that Danny Finkelstein character who appeared on the Piers Morgan one, then did a round on the, on BBC on, you know, and it became a talking point for a week in the media here. And the media love to have a figurehead. They love to have a face to put on it. Trump has just come out and said, oh, anti-Semitism is not welcome in MAGA. And of course, the face of that was Nick again. So they love to do this. They love to elevate somebody to be the face of it. And it just so happens to be him. So that would be my explanation for him.
I mean, I also fear that the same thing with the the same thing as with the Kanye story will happen, that basically you generate for a while all this interest in this topic and then do the rug pull and associate any discussion with that with a complete lunatic or a complete PR disaster. So it's on the one thing, yes, I kind of like that the discourse seems to be opening up and not just on Twitter, even on sites like Facebook on and Instagram. But I fear that there's a bigger picture we're not really seeing right now behind it.
I mean, this is a whole other topic to get into, but I do think that a large catalyst for a lot of this is actually just the real life events since October the 7th and then what Israel has done. I think that is actually the thing that has been quote-unquote radicalizing left and right because of what they've done in broad daylight and then expected everybody to shut up about it or just accept it or to say, oh, well, because of what happened 80 years ago, you just have to take this on the chin, we get to do it type thing. And people left and right just weren't having it. So one of the reasons I think for the explosion of this sort of stuff is because it does actually resonate. People are ready to hear what like Anna Kasparian has been saying, what Nick has been saying, and so on and so forth. And I think that the minute they're in a rear guard action to try to put the genie back into the bottle, and that's going to be very difficult when it's been on the scale it has. But I think that. You see, I think they are still thinking in a slightly older paradigm in a way that they can use these old tactics now in the current environment. They're still struggling to get a handle on what exactly to do about it all. Who knows what's going to happen with all of that? It's ongoing.
It fits well with the topic because it shows how easily all this online smartphone sphere can be influenced. Back in the early 2010s or late 2010s, what the Twitter files showed, you could basically generate radical but ultimately ineffective groups basically on command by creating the certain kind of conditions. And it took a lot of useful energy that existed and basically vented it into the atmosphere. And this is not just like nowadays we have all of these distractions, but even beyond that, there are so many opportunities for a permanent entrenched interest group to use all of this in a non-productive way and make people basically either more miserable or completely waste their time. And even today, finding actual useful things to do, which there are a couple, is really hard. It takes effort. You need to look around. You have to actively search for them. And just scrolling online is way easier.
All right. Well, there we are. But because of its usefulness, I struggle to believe that ultimately, I mean, I would love, just as a natural scientific experiment for Keir Starmer to ban X, okay, I'd love to see that happen. I don't think he's going to. I think ultimately he'll have a voice in his ear saying, you can't do this, Keir. because what happens when all those people go back into the real world? They're more useful to the state addicted to Twitter than they are offline. More useful online than offline. And I think it's only a matter of time before the powers that be figure that out. That it's more useful to have everybody outraged and addicted to slop than it is out there talking in pubs, you know, engaging with their local environment and so on. Do you understand what I mean? It's useful to power, in my view. So
if people, if the, let's say the opposition is online, they can be monitored. Power always know what they're talking about, what they're doing, how they're organizing. But if they're offline, it becomes kind of a black box. You really don't know what the opposition is doing. So you would need older kinds of intelligence techniques to control them, but this is much more expensive and difficult. So yeah, I really think, on the one hand, of course, I would not know you and I would even not know Wilhelm without the internet and social media. But on the other hand, it really is a surrogate activity. It is. It gives people the impression that they are doing something, but really they are just entertaining themselves. It's a form of entertainment, and it's not really active resistance or a positive change.
Well, everybody, I hope you've been entertained. Where can people find you guys?
On our channel, Consequent Frei, on YouTube and on Twitter. And at the next Karstage, the Witten event in Germany.
I'll just remind people, 25% off all courses with promo code Shorjan. And we will see you guys again tomorrow. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.